How soon can you tell them? The story of Andy and Roger illustrates the need to recognize good qualities and give praise. Andrew is a gentleman's gentleman, a consummate professional, and a world-class negotiator. I walked into Andy's office for our monthly meeting to find him distraught. His first words were, "Roger resigned." Roger was Andy's heir apparent. Andy had great plans for Roger. He continued, "Roger took another job. It's a complete dead end for him." "But why?" I asked. Andy shook his head. "He saw me move other people around in the organization and assumed I didn't have a plan for him, assumed he was being passed over because I didn't think highly of him." "But you had great plans for him," I said. "How could he not have known that?" "I felt it was best not to promise him anything," Andy responded. "You never know what's going to happen. I planned to promote him in time, soon actually, but felt that it wouldn't be politically correct if I told him what I had in mind." "Can you save him?" I asked. "I tried, believe me, but his pride is involved. He won't budge. A year from now, he'll be miserable." We sat quietly, Andy with his head in his hands. After a while, I ventured a question. "Maybe it's too soon to know, but what have you learned from this?" Andy's eyes glistened. "I didn't tell him I loved him. I thought he knew." Appreciation, praise, unfiltered, unqualified. There is so little of it going around. While it might not have been appropriate for Andy to lay out the details of what he had in mind for Roger, after all, reality can and does shift. It was appalling to Andy to realize that Roger really did not know that Andy held him in high regard. The notion that you could die today, so who haven't you hugged, may seem a bit sappy. Yet it's a real possibility. You could check out any time with no advance notice. So could others in your life. A taxi driver in San Francisco recently told me, "It's just never been in the cards for me to have a close, loving relationship with my parents in person. We got along from a distance, but never when we were together. Things started getting better a few years ago. I visited, and it went well. We had a good conversation, and I thought, finally, it's possible. I was planning another visit when my dad died, and now my mom is really sick. She's not going to last much longer." Who needs to hear from you? Who needs to know what you appreciate about him? If there is any possibility that they don't know how much you value them, there's a conversation that needs to occur. In the business world, confrontation, criticism, and even anger are more socially acceptable than expressions of appreciation. That's too bad, because appreciation is a truly value-creating activity. Sometimes the fiercest thing that needs saying is, "Thank you, I admire how you handled that. You're important in my life." And wouldn't it mean more if you named a specific quality, behavior, or physical trait that you appreciate in someone? For example, saying, "You're doing a good job," leaves a feeble wake compared to telling someone, "I overheard you handle that upset customer on the phone. It sounded like you were able to calm him down and really help him. I was impressed by your professionalism." Don't just tell people that you love them. Tell them why you love them, what it is about them that you love. Specifically, you go first. Sometimes individuals in a relationship have created such a negative emotional wake, one or both participants are ready to pull the plug. Even at that stage, fierce conversations can turn things around. And it requires going back to basics. Before any of us can answer the question, "Do I want this relationship at work or at home?" we must accomplish two things. First, our own lives must be working. In other words, we must have had the fierce conversations with ourselves that are necessary to sort out our own lives, to answer the big questions that we've already discussed, namely, where am I going? Why am I going there? Who is going with me? How am I going to get there? And following these conversations, we need to step onto the path and remain on it for longer than a week or a month. Otherwise, when we are unhappy, we will have difficulty determining the source. It's easy to assume someone else is the source of our angst and that we'd be happier if that person were no longer in our lives. However, the problem may lie much closer to home. Second, we must give to others what we most want to receive. Do you want to be with others who leave behind a positive emotional wake? Then leave one yourself. Do you long to be understood? Then focus on understanding others. Do you want your life partner to listen to you the way he or she did when you were first falling in love? Then plan an evening during which you will focus entirely on listening to your loved one. Well, it's highly unlikely any of this will happen until you go first, and one day doesn't count. You must extend to others what you want to receive. It begins with you. People express and receive love in different ways. Read The 5 Love Languages by Gary Chapman. Find out what language your spouse understands. Is it quality time, words of affirmation, gifts, thoughtful acts, physical touch? Whatever the language is, learn it and speak it. Make it important to learn the love language of your significant other and speak it to him or her every day. In difficult moments, ask, "What would love do?" and do it. Do not give up. Live what you are intent on learning. Here's where the magic comes in. A funny thing happens between people when one of them is really asking and really listening versus constantly interrupting with his or her own agenda and ascribing negative meanings to everything the other says. And when this person who is really listening operates from a well-built and well-stocked personal base camp, the invitation to come out from behind oneself into the conversation and make it real is often accepted. And once that happens, the armor begins to fall away, piece by piece, and we see, beneath the armor, a man's heart, a woman's heart, the heart of a child. Very few hearts are rejected. It is the armor that seals us off from one another and causes us to move so awkwardly through life. When we remove the armor, when we come out from behind ourselves, vulnerable and without defense, there is an opportunity to understand and to be understood. When you start to hear your children, your life partner, and your coworker at a deeper level, you'll start getting far more information from them. The quality of your listening will allow your children to discover who they are and to start valuing themselves. They will know that you care about them, and they will eagerly commit to their dreams for themselves. If we are capable of living our lives at times unconscious of what others are feeling, imagine how easy it is to toss off comments, blithely unaware of our emotional wake's effect on others. A negative emotional wake is expensive. Individuals, teams, customers, and family members pay the price. In order to leave a positive wake and lessen the opportunity for an inaccurate spin to be attached to your messages, learn to deliver the message without the load. This is a concept that was introduced to me by my colleague, Pat Murray. Loaded messages come in many guises. At times they arrive courtesy of a person who uses sugary sweet words, yet who seems to have a malevolent undertone. Our radar picks up something else, some hidden agenda perhaps, embedded in the message, leaving us uneasy and reluctant to trust. It wasn't anything the person actually said, but rather something in the air around the message that didn't feel good. Our impeccable radar warns us to obey our instincts and be careful. Consequently, we do not trust that person. We do not look forward to our next conversation, and we withhold ourselves from him or her in countless invisible ways. Other loads are delivered straightforwardly, impossible to miss. An example is the parent who, no matter what the child has achieved, says, "That's really good, honey. Yet next time, why don't you do it this way?" The load attached to this message is, "Nothing you do is good enough." I often ask workshop participants to think of someone whose behavior they want to confront and imagine what they would say to that person. Then I ask each participant to identify his or her unique fingerprint, the load they would be tempted to attach to the message. Typical responses include such loads as blaming, using sarcasm, threatening, exaggerating, saying, "If I were you," or asking, "Why did you do that?" instead of, "What were you trying to do?" Here's your assignment. Take a moment to recall one of your conversations at work or at home that did not go well. Forget about the other person's ineffective behavior. Focus on yourself. Revisit the conversation. Play it back in your head like a movie. See the expression on your face. What was your body language? Replay your words and listen to the tone with which they were spoken. View in your head the part of the conversation when your partner became upset or angry. What did you say or do that seemed to trigger your partner's response? What load did you attach to your message? Is that your typical unique fingerprint? What effect did it have on the conversation? Attaching a load to a message leaves the relationship worse off than it was before you opened your mouth. Given that one of the four purposes of all fierce conversations is to enrich relationships, we need to acknowledge our load if we have one. But beware! Don't become one of those persons who is so cautious that not only is there no load, there's no message. If we can agree that our goal is to deliver the message without the load, what should we do when we're triggered, when our buttons get pushed? Unfortunately, for most of us, the instant our buttons are pushed, all our hard-won skills fly straight out the window. We all have buttons. Mine invariably gets pushed when I feel that I've been grossly misinterpreted, or when what I have to say seems not to be valued. Whether or not someone intends this, those perceptions on my part invite instant triggering. When I'm triggered, I have two ingrained reactions, two automatic, hardwired responses. One is to exit the conversation by clamming up or walking out the door. The other is to make accusations and hurl blame. I'm not proud of this. It's just what every fiber of my body wants to do. Of course, the instant I am triggered, my reaction triggers everyone else in the conversation. Then they do whatever they do when they're triggered, and we quickly arrive at end game. It's over, not pretty. We've all seen it happen. When we are triggered, it is essential to fight off the tendency to attach a load. This story about a crucible may be helpful. Years ago, I went to Denver to meet a dear friend from high school days at the foundry where her 8-foot bronze of a cowboy carrying a calf was being poured. In a foundry, the crucible is what holds the molten metal, which is then poured from the crucible into molds to cool and harden so that it can become the work of art conceived by the artist. I was watching her sculpture take shape as the molten bronze hissed and steamed. The question that intrigued me was, what the heck is the crucible made out of that it isn't melting? The foundry owner explained, most crucibles are made of fragile materials, essentially some of the same ingredients in porcelain. If a crucible were dropped on a concrete floor, it would crack or shatter. When a new crucible arrives, I strike it to see if it will ring. If it has a sharp sound, it's okay. If it has a dull, thuddy sound, it's damaged. The foundry owner warmed to the topic and continued, the gold and silver used in computers are refined in crucibles. Your dentist has a crucible. You'll find castings in hospitals, cars, cemeteries. Crucibles have a role in forming castings that take people from birth to death. As do our conversations, I thought. Then I had an epiphany. What if I could become an utterly dependable crucible, a strong, resilient vessel in which profound change could safely take place for my clients, for my family and friends, for myself? In creating a work of art, the crucible has an important job, simply to hold, no matter what is poured into it, under extreme heat. I relate to the fragility of the crucible. If I get dropped, I could get hurt. I could crack or break. I'm vulnerable. However, during important conversations, my job is to hold, so that we are able to discuss what needs discussing, no matter how challenging the topic, and no matter how fragile and vulnerable I am feeling at the time. The image of the crucible reminds me that works of art form as a result of fierce conversations. Those works of art are the enduring relationships essential to our happiness, success, and peace of mind. Each of us is a place where conversations occur. You are a physical, emotional, spiritual, and intellectual place where conversations happen. You do not need a special weekend getaway to a romantic B&B in order to have that important conversation with your significant other. You do not need a title, a boardroom, or a fancy office to have the conversation needed to enrich your relationship with your boss, colleague, or customer. You do not need a diploma to be a human being, to be a friend. Do you remember the African greeting exchange? I see you, and I am here. When I don't see you, I am unaware of what is going on for you. I am unaware of my effect on you. When I do see you, I am able to pay fierce attention to not only the words between us, but their effect as well. I see you. I am here. What a lovely way to begin a conversation. So how can each of us reconcile being real, delivering the real message, and taking responsibility for our emotional wake? How do we reconcile feelings of anger with authenticity? How do we deliver the message clearly and cleanly without the load? What is our responsibility to ourselves and to other human beings? First, recognize that everything you say creates an emotional wake. Second, understand that you can create a wake without any emotion on your part. Check in frequently with others to see what kind of wake you are creating. Third, get in touch with your intent, be it noble or sinister. If your intent is sinister, now is not the time to speak. If your intent is good, it is possible to admit to anger and still leave a positive emotional wake. Finally, accept the responsibility to be present, aware, authentic, appropriate, truthful, and clear. It's the idea behind your words that matters. Learning to deliver the message without the load requires that you speak with clarity, conviction, compassion, and passion. You are not required to become a wimp. You do have certain rights, you know. Here are half a dozen of them. You have the right to get your core needs met in a relationship, or at least the right not to have them violated. You have the right to ask dumb questions. You have the right to confront issues that are troubling you. You have the right to disagree. You have the right to say yes, and you have the right to say no. My best conversations result from obeying Annie Dillard's advice about writing. In The Writing Life, Dillard describes learning to chop wood. Aiming for the top of an upended log resulted in splinters and chips. It was only when the thought came to her to aim for the chopping block that she cleaved a log cleanly in two. Aim past this conversation, past these words. Where do you want to go with your work, or this individual, or this marriage, or this life? What is your destination? That's your chopping block. Aim for that in every important conversation. Sometimes we aim at the wrong thing or forget to aim at anything. Blah, 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 we hear ourselves. Darn, I'm doing it again. Okay, where was it I wanted to go with my life? Might recalling that help us navigate a particular conversation? Well, it can't hurt. What if your intended destination changes? I hope it does change as you get older, as you figure out what you are and what you aren't. Life is wonderfully curly, remember? By the way, do not begin your comments with truthfully or frankly or honestly. That always makes me wonder if someone wasn't speaking truthfully before. Just speak truthfully, frankly, and honestly and get on with it. Over the last several years, I have developed a meaningful relationship with the word no. I highly recommend it. If we do not learn to say no, there will be no space in our lives when a powerful yes appears. Each of us will say yes and no to people, to ideas, to the myriad possibilities that present themselves over the course of our lives. It is impossible to say yes to everyone and everything. Saying no is not the problem. In fact, it is often the solution. It's the way you say no that gets you in trouble. It's the way you disagree that harms or enriches a relationship. For example, "you don't know what you're talking about" is guaranteed to prickle the person on the receiving end. "I have a different perspective" will likely go down smoother and keep the conversation going. The challenge is to say what we need to say, what is true and right for ourselves, one conversation at a time, and to say it in a way that does not leave boats crashing against the dock in our wake. There is one requirement for a fierce conversation. You must complete the conversation. Hang in there. See your conversations through to completion. No fair starting a pebble rolling and then running when the landslide begins. No fair behaving in ways guaranteed to evoke anger or fear or sadness in any sensate human being, and then exiting the conversation declaring, "I can't talk to you, you're too angry." That's cheating. If you create a mess, either single-handedly or in partnership with someone, do not bolt when things get emotional. Some topics of conversation are dicey at best, but if you started it or you caused it, stay to the finish, even if the finish isn't what you had envisioned ahead of time. Sit, stay, complete. Sometimes you just need a well-oiled reverse gear. You might need to say, "I was wrong. I'm sorry." These are important words that too often remain lodged in our throats, even when we know they are desperately needed. To whom do you owe an apology? Above all, admit when you're wrong, and if it's appropriate, apologize. People who are never wrong are teetering on the edge of divinity and likely teetering at the edge of the end of a relationship. You may ask, when is it okay to lie? I say, when all else fails, lie like a dog. I do it very seldom, but I have lied on occasion. Shocking, isn't it? I do it to avoid inflicting completely undeserved and unnecessary pain on others, and sometimes on myself. Recently, for example, a friend named Sandy called to ask how she could tell an online dating candidate whose photo she had just seen that she was not interested in meeting him. His accompanying email had read, "If you see the photo and change your mind, it's okay." Very sad. Heartbreaking. What do you do when you encounter an individual who is used to rejection and whom you too intend to reject? Use this old fallback. When in doubt, ask, "What would love do?" It wouldn't have felt very loving and would have done no earthly good to give the honest reply, "I'm glad it's okay, 'cause now that I know what you look like, I'm not interested." So Sandy lied. She emailed him that she had met someone else with whom she wanted to spend time before exploring other possibilities. Yes, there were issues of guilt, feeling small and petty, thinking that she should be bigger than the appearance thing. But the truth was, his physical appearance was not remotely attractive to Sandy. She would not have been able to get past it. Life is short. You have to pick the personal issues on which to work. This one wasn't at the very top of Sandy's list, so why be unkind? Where we get into trouble is in taking the high road too often. It's easy to withhold important messages from others, supposedly for the sake of being kind, when in reality what we most need to do is come out from behind ourselves into the conversation and let someone know how we really feel. Your assignment now is to write down the name of someone at work or at home to whom you need to deliver a message. Craft your message, taking care not to attach a load to it. Here are a few ideas to get you started. My employee, Carolyn, the message I want to deliver is, I'd like for you to step up to the plate on this project and become less dependent on me. Or, my son, Alan, the message I want to deliver is, I'm very proud of you. What is your idea behind this conversation? In other words, what do you want of this relationship? Remind yourself that you have a responsibility to come out from behind yourself into the conversation and make it real while taking responsibility for your emotional wake. A word of congratulations. You've come a long way since we started this program. You've deepened your understanding of 6 principles of fierce conversations and developed your skills. You're having memorable conversations that interrogate reality, provoke learning, tackle tough issues, and enrich relationships. You'll be surprised by Principle 7 coming up. Practicing it will add the perfect grace note to your conversations yet to come.
Principle 7. Let silence do the heavy lifting.
Do you know someone who will most likely die with his or her mouth open? Many CEOs could go on this list. That is not good. A dazzling way with words rarely proves to be enough to guarantee success as a leader. Many people attempt to forge relationships exclusively through words, lots of words. However, the best leaders talk with people, not at them. Talking at people is a common affliction. In fact, on a purely practical note, did you know that 8 out of 10 sales proposals fail, and 50% of those 8 fail because we spent too much time talking about ourselves or our product, and not enough time listening to the customer before we explained how wonderful doing business with us would be? We all know people, intent on impressing us, who talk so much they turn us off completely. Such people are often unconscious of the effect they're having on others. Though their stories are at times entertaining and laced with insight, after a while we get the feeling that we are merely a spot on the wall to which they direct their comments. It is exceedingly difficult, almost impossible, to gain a firm footing in conversations filled with noise. There is a place for big, noisy gatherings. I enjoy the energy, the full sensory experience of a room filled with high-spirited individuals, the family gatherings in my home during the Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays, the parties celebrating individual or organizational milestones. However, while there are remarkable conversations to be experienced in the crush of crowds, the need for spaciousness in our most important conversations inspires me to take work teams on retreat to places where we can build a fire rather than to a traditional hotel. We've taken over a small lodge in Sun Valley. We boated in the San Juan Islands. We had time simply to hang out beside a crackling fire, perhaps cook dinner together, and talk about nothing, about something. And when it was time to talk, we turned off our cell phones. In theaters, an announcement is usually made before the curtain goes up. Please turn off all cell phones, and if you have a piece of candy or a breath mint, please unwrap it now. This always inspires laughter and gratitude. I wish important conversations began with similar instructions. Let me tell you about my experience with a client named Bob Sloan. As Bob sat in his executive office, he blew words like bubbles. Lips puckered, as if to make car sounds for the amusement of a child. His pout was so extreme, by the time the sound of a word made its way from his mouth to my ears, he had gone on to the next word. The effect was that of watching an out-of-sync movie. He went from word to word to word, endlessly. To make matters worse, he spoke in a monotone. Consequently, I often struggled to pay attention during his droning monologue. During my third visit to his office, I determined to improve things, at least from my perspective. I mustered my resolve and began to talk on top of Bob's words. "Bob, you remind me of someone who had a style of lovemaking that did not require my presence." Though Bob usually ignored my attempts to interrupt, this time he paused and asked, "What did you say?" "Just that you remind me of someone," I said. "The point is that I don't think you've taken a breath in the last 20 minutes, and I haven't been able to get a word in edgewise." He smiled sheepishly. "Yeah, my wife tells me the same thing." And he kept right on talking. About 10 minutes later, I got up and walked to the door. Bob looked at me quizzically as I paused in the doorway. "Don't stop," I said. "I'm going to take a little walk, maybe visit with some of your employees. You don't need me." "Wait a second. This is what I pay you for," Bob said. "I see it differently," I responded. I knew I had to be bold and clear to get my message across. "You did not buy my time or my posterior in a chair. You paid to have an interaction with me, and you're not getting it. Consequently, I'm having trouble paying attention. Perhaps some fresh air will revive me." I waited as the words sank in, and then continued. "Bob, there are times for each of us when what we need most is simply to talk to someone who is really listening. There is also value in dialogue. You and I haven't had the second experience. Now, I've got a pretty strong personality. If I've given up trying to interject a comment into our conversations, I wonder where else this is going on in your life and what price you might be paying." Bob looked away, down at his desk, out the window. Finally, I asked, "So, where else is this going on?" He answered immediately, "At home. My wife is unhappy." He stared at his hands. "Probably with some people here, too." "Who in the company is unhappy?" I asked. "I don't know." "Who would it be if you did know?" Bob smiled faintly. "If I did know, it would be Jim, my director of engineering." "Okay," I said. "Can we talk about this? And about your marriage? And I suggest that we allow some silences as we talk, so that we can sit and think and feel and get as in touch with reality as possible." Bob nodded. I sat down again, and we began our first real conversation. In an article titled "Language, Customs, and Other Cultural Tips for Job Interviews," Chinese job applicants are counseled with this advice. The Chinese are more likely to accept or even to appreciate silent periods in conversation. American custom is not to allow long silence during conversations, especially during business meetings, including the interview. Silence makes many Americans nervous. A website advises Finnish exchange students that an American characteristic is general discomfort with silence in conversations, homes, working places. This strikes me as embarrassing, but true. And it's no wonder. From the time most Americans are small children, we are taught to dislike silence. The punishment of being sent to one's room for quiet time or time out causes children to plead for mercy and promise to be good. And what is this dreaded sentence they wish to avoid? Silence. It is a phenomenon of our times that for many people, silence is almost unendurable. Silence makes us nervous. As adults, we fear that silence may be interpreted as low self-esteem or questionable intelligence. We feel we're expected to interject witty comments and wise observations on the spot. Many feel silence is a form of non-participation, signaling lack of interest. We fear people will think we have nothing more to say. The worry may be, if I just sit here and think for a moment, somebody else will jump in and say the clever thing I would have liked to say. At a workshop with executives of a global organization moving at the speed of light, we were discussing the question, "What am I pretending not to know?" The house came down when one executive admitted, "My question ought to be, what am I pretending to know? I say the first thing that comes to my mind and pray to God that it is accurate." For fear of being thought clueless, have you dived into a conversation, throwing out opinions, arguing your point, defending your ideas throughout a debate, only to discern later, once you stop to catch your breath, that there was another, wiser road you could have taken? It is understandable that emerging leaders believe they need to be fast on their conversational feet, able to engage in clever repartee. That is what is admired and rewarded. The belief is that leaders always have answers at the ready. It's not okay to just sit there. You've got to say something. Fierce conversations, however, require silence. In fact, the more emotionally loaded the subject, the more silence is required. And of course, this carries over into our homes, into our personal relationships. Sometimes we need silence in which to make a decision about the closeness we feel for our companions or the distance we feel from them. Our habitual ways of talking with or at each other prevent us from allowing silence to help us get in touch with what we really want to say. Some signs that indicate silence is needed include interrupting by talking over someone else, formulating your own response while someone is talking, responding quickly with little or no thought, jumping in with advice before an issue has been clarified, and monopolizing the airspace. Sometimes a dramatic intervention is required in order to stop the words, in order to start a conversation. There are issues that our colleagues and customers will ignore every time they come up. If we are not alert, we will walk with others right past the issue. We may sense something is there, but the conversation is moving too fast. Or, because we are so invested in playing the role of expert, we fill the air with words, missing the real issue entirely. When our ego is dialing 911, we wouldn't notice if our own teeth were crumbling as we drone on and on. Often, my role is to slow down a conversation, and silence is my greatest tool in this. As we talk with people, as we sit with them in silence, whatever is in the way, whether it's anger, impatience, insensitivity, may fall away. It is in silence that such emotions and behaviors reveal themselves as unnecessary. I am friends with an elderly couple who held each other and cried when their border terrier died. For 12 years, the dog had slept at the foot of their bed, snoring quietly. Each night, when one of them said, "Well, I believe it's bedtime for me," the other person and the dog rose and trundled off to bed. Each took an assigned place, the three of them breathing through the night, shifting positions carefully so as to not disturb. And in the morning, when one got up, so did the other two. "Good morning," sitting quietly, sipping the coffee, reading the newspaper, exchanging plans for the day, and dreams of the night before. When I visit them, we sit quietly and contentedly, once four of us, now three, in silence. Impossible to explain to others great and easy friendships like this, nurtured in silence. Have you lost a healthy, affectionate relationship with silence? Are you uncomfortable with even brief moments of silence? Do you turn on the TV not to watch it, but to be comforted by the background noise that you have come to require? What if you turned off the TV? Turned off the radio? Do you know what the wind sounds like in the corn, in the hedgerows? When was the last time you listened to the sound of rain falling? Do you know the sound of your own breathing? During my conversations with the people most important to me, silence has become my favorite sound because that is when the work is being done. Of all the tools I use during conversations and all the principles I keep in mind, silence is the most powerful of all. Deepak Chopra refers to the space between thoughts as the place where insight can make itself known. The trouble is, for most of us, there is no space between thoughts. This is true for me. To my delight, I discovered that fly fishing is a remedy for my affliction, allowing me to flip the off switch in my head. When I've spent half an hour or so entirely focused on placing a fly on a particular glint of water, there begins to be spaciousness between my thoughts. These days I fly fish because it gives me an opportunity to visit fish in the beautiful places where they live and because I need what it does for me. I also need what silence accomplishes during my conversations with others. Thinking back, I see that my best and most memorable conversations have been filled with silences. How do we let silence do the heavy lifting? Provide it. Allow silence to fill in the greater meaning that needs to be there. Perhaps if I close my mouth, you'll open yours. When you ask the opening question in Mineral Rights, what is the most important thing you and I should talk about? Keep silent. Wait quietly. The universe will not respond if we grow uncomfortable and impatient. Sometimes all that is needed is that we get out of the way. Stop trying to help. During company meetings, often the best responses, the most brilliant solutions, come from the person who has sat silently listening for a very long time while the rest of us filled the air with debate. Even when called upon, such individuals often appear reluctant to speak, sitting in reflective silence for agonizing moments while others click ballpoint pens and glance at their watches. Then he or she speaks, and everyone else in the room is compelled to shift to a broader, wiser perspective, with the result that elegant, complete answers begin to emerge. Since my work emphasizes the value of silence, it is important to acknowledge that not all silence is healthy. The silence I recommend is the restful kind, the kind that invites us to hear the quieter voices, the kind that allows us to hear the birds sing. I do not mean the silence of non-participation, of passivity, of, I really don't care what you do or what you think. I do not mean the cold war of silence fought by couples, the indifferent silence that chills their hearts when they are starving for close connection. I do not mean the silence that denies topics that are uncomfortable. Several months ago in a workshop, a woman named Nora admitted that when another participant had given her feedback following an exercise, she had initially been angry. "I wanted to jump down your throat and rip it out," she said. It helped that Nora was smiling when she said that. I found this honesty appealing. In fact, the comment further endeared Nora to the others in the workshop, including the recipient of her comment. Yet later that day, a man pulled me aside, referred to Nora's comment, and said, "How'd you like to live with someone like that?" I responded, "I prefer honest, active aggression to covert, passive aggression any day." Many of us have experienced hostile silences that are far more harmful than full disclosure. Silence is a popular form of passive aggression, intended as punishment. It means, "I don't like what you did or said, so I'm just not going to play. I will withhold myself from you. See how you like that." It can be an attempt to manipulate, to teach others that if they behave in certain ways, there will be consequences. This backfires, of course. Silence over a period of time regarding an important issue will likely have negative consequences. Clamming up and refusing to talk about a particular subject at home or in the workplace reflects a decision to protect yourself at all costs. This includes taking the risk that someone important to you may eventually choose to leave the relationship if you refuse to address the issue. Here are some more thoughts, though, on the benefits of healthy silence. Silence offers us an opportunity to think and plan down board. Each action step we decide upon will set other things in motion. None of us is behaving in a vacuum. Everything we do has consequences for the rest of the company or the family. We need to think in terms of, if we do this, who and what will be impacted and how? What other steps may become necessary? Sometimes teams need to sit quietly and think about these questions. Silence allows us the space in which to focus on the cause, not the effect. Half the battle is identifying and resolving the real issues, as opposed to dwelling on symptoms illustrated with long stories. In work teams, when someone brings an issue to his or her colleagues for resolution, if we are fortunate, after an extended silence during which everyone reflects on what has been offered for discussion, someone will say, "I don't think that's the real issue. I think the real issue is," and we're off and running, recognizing with relief that we are on track at last. The problem named is the problem solved. Silence allows us to reflect on and ultimately identify the problem, so that we may focus our limited time and resources on removing obstacles in the company's way. Silence allows us to reflect on basic beliefs and paradigms regarding a particular issue before moving to options and strategy. It is imperative to give ourselves and our teams the challenge and the silence in which to ask ourselves what beliefs that we currently hold might be in the way of innovation and improvement. This is almost impossible for anyone to do in a room or a house full of words. Silence allows everyone in the room to participate fully. No matter what our areas of expertise, each of us has insights and ideas about other aspects of the organization. Silence assists individuals who usually take lots of airtime in listening more and talking less. Silence allows quieter individuals an opportunity to speak. Learning is provoked for everyone. Silence is the best-kept secret for generating family dialogue. If you want your children to talk to you, make silence your primary skill. I used to interrogate my daughters lovingly each day on the way home from school. What did you do at school today? Did you have fun? What did you learn? If you're a parent, you may be smiling because you know from experience that such questions rarely elicit the lengthy responses we hoped for. Gradually, I learned that the more I allowed silence following my questions, the more my daughters would willingly fill it with words like, "Guess what my teacher said," or "Want to hear something really weird?" When my daughters spoke, I could entice them to continue by simply saying, "Uh-huh," "Wow, really?" or even, "No way," or I could simply nod and smile. Silence allows us to scan our heads and hearts for ground truths. Silence allows us to examine the flotsam and jetsam in our lives and to determine its usefulness, affording us an opportunity to clear our personal and corporate windshields. What is silence trying to teach us? It is teaching us how to feel. Silence encourages us to explore a more difficult peace. Before any of us can hope to engage others in wonderfully fierce conversations, we must engage ourselves in a dialogue so real, so fierce, so filled with silences that we can hear our own heartbeat. Put your fingers up to your ears and plug your ears. Listen to your heartbeat. Look in a mirror. Look deep. What might you hear if you sat in silence and conversed with that person in the mirror? Perhaps he or she has much to tell you. Samuel Johnson wrote, "That is the happiest conversation where there is no competition, no vanity, but a calm, quiet interchange of sentiments." It is my goal that your colleagues at work and those closest to you at home will experience this during their conversations with you. This requires that you take a deep breath, ground yourself, and ask, "What is the most important thing you and I should be talking about today?" Then, step with your partners into territory where there may be dragons, where you have plenty of questions and zero answers, where you leave your expert hat out in the hall, adopt a beginner's mind, and listen with every subatomic particle of your body, where you screw your courage to the sticking place and ask the question that expands the possibilities for everyone, including you, and then listen and speak again. All of the conversations in the world cruise on a crest of silence, and sometimes the silence overshadows the rest. Let silence, like a Zen koan, be your riddle. Fill your conversations with silences during which reality may be interrogated, learning may be provoked, tough challenges may be tackled, and relationships may be enriched. The risk? I will be known. I will be seen. I will be changed. Over the next 24 hours during your conversations at work and at home, give yourself this private challenge. I will allow spaciousness in my conversations so that I can reflect on what others have said before I speak. I will invite my partners to do the same. In doing so, I hope to get closer to what is authentic and valuable. If you suspect that conversations filled with silence may feel strange or uncomfortable for you or others, it may help to say at some point, "I'd like a moment to reflect on what you've said." If your partners are going too fast or seem impatient with you, with the conversation, or with themselves, you might say, "I believe this is an important topic. Let's slow down a bit so we can both digest what we're saying and consider where we need to go from here." Here, as in all the assignments throughout this program, you will gain skill and insight when you debrief following a conversation. Reflect on your own participation in the conversation, good or bad, and what happened as a result. It helps to use the 7 principles and 4 purposes of a fierce conversation as your checklist. For example, ask yourself, did silence help us interrogate reality, provoke learning, tackle a tough challenge, enrich our relationship? Several of my clients have suggested that you know you've had a fierce conversation when you overheard yourself saying things you didn't know you knew, when you didn't take notes yet you remember every word, when you listened with more than your ears, when you took yourself and your companion personally and seriously, and ultimately, when you left the conversation satisfied, fully alive, and eager for more. Some time ago, I chose to live my life at the conversational cliff's edge, breathing my way through a whole series, a whole lifetime of fierce conversations with friends, family, clients, colleagues, and of course with myself. While the principles of fierce conversations may be impossible to live up to every day in every conversation, they are certainly something to shoot for your organization's sake, for the sake of your personal relationships, and most important, for your own sake. Don't be hard on yourself if you stumble from time to time. Don't let a failed conversation keep you from trying again. hang on and hang in. Take it one conversation at a time, one day at a time. Rather than settle on a plateau of maturity, look around for people whose conversations are memorable, people who wake you up and provoke your learning, people who are real. Excellence rubs off. You will be better company for having kept the best company. For me, an unforeseen reward for practicing the seven principles has been a sense of sinew growing throughout my body. I've lost weight, gotten lean. Maybe it has to do with being willing to be vulnerable, without defense, no protective mechanisms, no armor required. Perhaps it has to do with my effort to trim all that I say to the barest bone. How close to the bone can I get? How authentic? How accurate and clear? The result is that these days I travel light, agenda-free. So where should you begin? By doing. Action teaches. Engaging in fierce conversations every day will reveal the value of saying what you need to say, what you long to say. Should you run out the door, collar the first poor bloke who catches your eye, and haul his sorry backside off for a fierce conversation? Not yet. Instead, begin by tuning in to yourself. Spend time alone, in silence. When silence has performed its useful work, listen to music. Country, classical, blues, rock, opera, Celtic, whatever pleases you. Close the door, turn off the TV, let the answering machine kick in, put on music that you love, and let yourself feel. Right now I am listening to Kelly Jo Phelps' CD, Sky Like a Broken Clock. I am in love with his sound. A cross between Springsteen, Doc Boggs, and someone from somewhere on the banks of the Mississippi. The lyrics are lovely, but secondary. It's simply what this music evokes in me, unbidden, dropping me into a funky, smooth, and groovy place where I want to pour a glass of red wine, light a fire, and reminisce. I remember evenings with friends playing our guitars and singing by the Missouri River my freshman year of college. I can see Kelly Jo Phelps' music with my eyes. He's tapped into an artery somehow. You can't get that just anywhere. Different gifts, memories, and emotions would be evoked by listening to Rostropovich playing Bach's cello suites or to Alasdair Fraser's Scottish fiddle. I pick my moods with my music, gifts all. Listen to music that you love. It will allow you to feel what is there for you to feel, even if you have locked the door and wedged a chair under the knob. That's why we need music. Seek it. Sometimes avoid it. There are some songs I have to turn off. Just can't take it right now. And read a book. Put down the newspaper, the magazine, the stock market report. Pick up a classic work of fiction or a new one. Pick up Tolkien. Lose yourself with hobbits, orcs, and wizards. Lose yourself in hope of finding yourself. If you want to meet someone who has had an extended fierce conversation with herself and offers that marvelously flawed self to any who care, read Bird by Bird or Traveling Mercies by Anne Lamott. Read Pilgrim at Tinker Creek by Annie Dillard. Or read A Joseph Campbell Companion. I fantasize what it would be like to have these people as neighbors. Oh, the conversations we could have. When there's a good book in the house, why turn on the TV? Read poetry. Read good poetry, if possible. You'll know it's good when it evokes something for you, a memory, a vivid picture, an emotion, an insight. Read David White's poems. Pick up The Gift, poems by Hafiz, the great Sufi master, translated by Daniel Ladinsky. Here was a man happy to be in his own skin. You will smile, laugh out loud, and take walks. There has been much talk of being on the path. Let the way itself arrive. For me, the way is an ongoing, robust conversation with all that life has to offer. During walks, I converse with lavender roses beside the ocean. I dream amid the blue-eyed grass and nodding campion, by a laurel that is mated with a copper beech, conversing with my own essential nature. Back at home, the conversation continues with faithful friends and family. What matters is how quickly we do what our souls direct. This past fall, after leading several workshops,